I got most of the last one, but I sort of missed the last 15 minutes because various reasons. Okay. Any other? Any? That's what leaps to my mind to talk about on the exam. Okay. I mean, I would prefer if there were 500 of you out there. It seems like this stuff is things everybody should know, but you're the ones I'm teaching it to, so.
Yeah. In the interpretation section on number 3, the last part of the question says, is there anything in the first sentence explain what Cain does?
Yeah, well, the issue there, what I talked about was Cain kills Abel, and you have the sort of mystery of this wicked act. And the question is there any relationship, not to the disfavor God showed to Cain, but to his actual occupation?
Okay.
Why should God disfavor the agriculture? Is it the I can't even remember him, the agricultural guy? And I said in class, people just debate that, and a preacher will just sort of make up, you know, one or the other. If you look at it, it's impossible to figure out. Now you can say, well, the Bible tends to like shepherds, you know, as opposed to farmers. And I kind of bought that as an interpretation, as a kind of guess. I hope you don't really totally believe it's true, because you could take the opposite opinion. The opposite opinion would be that there's no connection between these occupations. But that's all the facts we have. Right? And somehow whoever wrote that story figured this is what you need to know. So he might actually be saying, you know, what you need to know is sometimes these stories come with a lot of irrelevant facts. And the issue is murdering your brother has got nothing to do with who you are or God's favor. It's no excuse. One person actually said that on the exam. Okay. That these are in things that need to be interpreted, which is kind of our theme today. Any other question? Yeah. What was it? I didn't hear you. Oh, that was the typical one. We really don't know what it means. And I just want you to say, this is, many people, physically, it's hard to understand what waters are being separated. Okay? Because nobody believes it's just the clouds and the oceans. It seems to be out there in heaven, there's another band of water out there. And we just talked about it, and on the videotape, Professor Goodhart talked about how there was a pun on words. Heavens has the word for waters in it, so therefore heavens was kind of a little joke. But it brought out the difficulty of interpreting literally the whole 7 days of creation. You can believe it if you want, but the text seems to be saying what we're saying here is this is a symbolic set of gestures. These 7 days are not days in any literal sense, because there weren't even days then, you know, in the 24-hour sense. These are symbolic meanings. Okay? How can you have light before you have the sun? It makes no sense to us, but if the light means something, if it's sort of meaning like God-like presence, then you don't need the sun. Right? You can delay it till day 4. And there's no received interpretation. Your guess is actually as good as anybody's on this stuff. Right? And certainly St. Augustine, who you're reading for next Tuesday, you know, is quite... And it was really the father, the intellectual father of Christianity, is quite clear about this. These are not days. All right? That's not what's important here. Right? And it's really the theme we have today. What's important here is certainly by the time you get to St. Paul, who I put in brackets on your syllabus because they didn't give us a selection, what's important, he couldn't care less about creation. This is not the issue. The issue is the part God plays in your life. You know, who cares about the water, right? Like it's, you know, it's what's in your heart that counts. That's his big message, right? So, and you can argue that message is already there. Okay. in the Old Testament, which is certainly what I would argue. All right. And I might as well, I don't know if I should make myself clear here. You get on a little delicate. I usually don't say anything about myself personally, but what the heck. My mother was a Southern Baptist, since we're doing religious. My mother is a Southern Baptist. My father was Jewish. I was brought up Unitarian. Okay. My older daughter was a total pagan. Okay. And very sarcastic about all things religious until her best friend died. And she's now become an Episcopalian. Okay, and because that's what happens when people die. Okay, and my son was bar mitzvah, but of course he couldn't care less about being Jewish, so he's given that up. I say only in America, this is good, right? I don't know. I actually, at one point in my life, they had a Mormon girlfriend, but that's so distant and dim to me. It's just much too far west. I have no comprehension of that. All right. So I think the whole thing's just, I think it's good American mishmash, and we'll leave it at that, all right? I think most. Anyway, so let's take a look. You want to see the Virgil video? Yeah, let's see a little video. You need to see Professor Kirby, the award-winning Professor Kirby from the Classics Department. Doing Virgil. Let's set it up. One passage here, which is from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 through 7, I think, which is, any way you cut it, the New Testament is a fairly remarkable document, even for, if you're not in the faith, you got to say, well, this is still pretty interesting stuff. Now, there's some weirdness in there that they leave out, right? No casting out devils in this anthology, and no snake handling. Right? But the argument is that's not really what the central issue. Although, if you move to Texas, it is, I guess. Anybody from Texas out there? why am I having trouble finding this? It's page, what is it? 1086. Yeah, let's look at page 1089. He's going to do the Virgil, but there's a famous passage in Virgil, which I was just waiting all semester to show you because it relates to this passage in the New Testament, and your anthology left it out. All right, so I'm going to just mention it here. Right at the top of 1089, Jesus is saying, go in through the narrow gate. And everything refers to heaven. Okay, because wide and spacious is the road that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in through it. Because narrow is the gate and cramped the road that leads to life, by which he means heaven, and few are they who find it. So this is a typical instance of a figure of speech. Life is not a road. A road is a road, but it's like a road. Okay? And there are two kinds of roads. There's the wide one and the narrow one. Right? And the wide one is easy. And the narrow one is hard. And the implication is a lot of people go on the wide one because you can get more people on it. And which way does that one lead? To hell. Anybody can get to hell. It's getting to heaven that's the hard one. So that's the narrow road. Right? So it's just an image. And it's remarkably similar to an image in the sixth book of Virgil, which is where Aeneas goes down to hell, or Hades. And I didn't have time to go over it, but it's certainly worth mentioning here. And this descent was the central passage for Virgil. Anyway, Aeneas has got to sort of, remember he's having trouble finding Rome, and he goes down to hell and he meets the shade of his father who says, look, I'll explain stuff to you. It's difficult philosophically and all this gibberish. But to get down to hell to meet the shade of his father, who's going to tell him what the signs will be, that he'll know that when he's gotten to this place that will be Rome. It's the moment when his men eat their plates. You figured that one out. All right, never mind. Okay. it turns out to be your plate's a big tortilla. So you eat it, right? To get down there to meet the ghost of his father, he has to get down to the underworld. And to get there, he has to go past the Sibyl, who's a sort of priestess in this cave with all the smoke going up. And it's a very druggy and dreamlike scene because, as I was trying to say, Virgil really plays both sides of reality here, the sort of dream euphoria side and the reality side. But eventually the Sibyl says to him, well, okay, you got to go pluck this branch off a tree with a golden apple on it, and you give it to the monster who's guarding the gate, right? But just remember, it's easy to get down to hell. The hard part's getting back up here. Okay, and Aeneas has sort of been wandering for 3 days in this cave trying to get directions to get down there, so you can imagine how hard it is to get back up, all right? And Virgil has a famous line, so easy the descent to hell, the hard part is getting up, okay? And I forgot to write it down. Faculus, you know, Vicensis Averni, easy the descent to hell, that's the word for hell, A-V-E-R-N-I. But to revoke your steps, but revocare gradum, you know, he says, hic opus hoc labor est. So I'll leave out the middle. Easy the descent to hell, but to revoke your steps, to come back, hic opus hoc labor est. That's the opus, the task. That's the singular of the word that becomes opera in the plural. Hoc labor, we have the word labor. That's, you know, your problem, getting back up. Well, this is a huge thought, and it certainly looks to me pretty similar to this road, all right? And it looks similar to everybody else who read Virgil's Aeneid for 2,000 years. And you remember my premise was that Virgil doesn't come down to American culture. If you lived in Italy, you'd know all about him. But it's a sort of continental thing, and we got Don Quixote, but we didn't get Aeneas. You know, we know Achilles, but we don't go to see Brad Pitt play Aeneas. It's just the way it happened. Yet everybody who learned Latin, in other words, anyone who was educated in a school for 2,000 years, this was the big treat to get to finally read the Aeneid. It's not that difficult, a Latin. You could do it by your third or fourth year. You can do it by your third year here at Purdue. You can do it in your second year. Okay, you can do it over the summer if you want this. Relax. Ancient Latin, 40 easy lessons. Okay. Highly recommended. All the graduate students I teach have to do it. Okay. Anyway, the people reading this during the Middle Ages said, don't you see? Virgil was clued in to the same truth that we're seeing here in the Bible. Now, they say he died in 20 BC. That's pretty close, isn't it? And the story was that Virgil had been given a little inkling of the truth. He was such a great poet. And you read this stuff, he is really pretty unbelievable. Right? God made a special dispensation for him. And the fact is, he allowed him to write the Aeneid, the story of pagan Rome, the founding of pagan Rome. But in reality, written by a Christian before the time. So everybody thought he was a Christian. Right? It's just one of the little miracles that God did. Right? And you read Virgil and this, you know, it's like all this smoke and this mirrors and clipping the hair. It makes a lot of sense, right, to see him that way. And certainly, we're going to get to Dante in this course, who's the greatest Italian poet. So Dante decides he's going to write the story of the passage of a person's soul, you know, through the kind of moral universe. So first thing you do is you go down and visit hell, And then the second part, you go through purgatory. And then the third part of the Divine Comedy, you go up through heaven. In the allegory, it's the road to hell. Okay, comes right out of the Bible. And Dante, the pilgrim, starts traveling down in this giant underworld. But the first thing he does is he meets a guide who's going to show him all the sights of hell, the sinners. And the guide he meets is the shadow or the shade or the ghost of Virgil. Dante's trying to climb this mountain to get to the sun, i.e. God, right? Three beasts block his path. He has to back up. God, I can't find God, right? There's a man standing there and says, I can help you. And, Dante goes, I know you. You're Virgil. Look just like him, because there were pictures of him. Okay? And Virgil says, yeah, follow me. You can't get up that mountain to that sun to see God until you first understand everything else. So I'm going to go through hell with you. Now, in the allegory, what it means is, if you want to understand, from Dante's perspective, writing in 1300 AD in Italy, I'll be repeating this, but might as well warm you up, okay? if you want to understand the horrors of hell, in other words, how bad people can be, right? All the sins, the lust, the murders, right? The treason, all types of force and fraud are the two big categories. You know, from violence to lying. You want to understand that, follow Virgil. Well, how do you follow Virgil? Well, Dante says, don't be so dumb. I mean, read the Aeneid. Don't you get it? Okay. To follow Virgil is to read the Aeneid. And we know, Dante said, that he's actually, you know, Christian. Okay. This guy's got some deep truth. Now, in the allegory, it turns out he doesn't have quite enough truth, so you can only follow Virgil through purgatory. Okay. You then get handed off to another Latin poet named Statius, who wrote a thing called the Thebaid, and he guides Dante through the last stages of purgatory, and they both jump off to the sphere of the moon, which is the first step in the paradise of Dante. So if you want to actually see God, you don't get that reading Virgil. He kept it hidden. Okay, as Dante said, he actually kept his. Well, never mind. I won't get into that. All right. Anyway, so there it is. That this Virgil was powerful stuff, and the sixth book was really the key. So let's. I'm trying to get Professor Kirby to talk about that in this video a little bit. All right. So. Oh, and, you know, why don't you do the same thing for me on this one? Just write a little note what you like and email it to me, because I'm going to edit this down to 10 minutes again. Could you do that for me? That really worked well last time. These are the first lines. We don't make a big deal, just in a short sentence. He wrote a poem predicting the birth of a son who would bring in a new world. By coincidence, sort of coincided with Christianity. And so everybody went, whoa.
It's ironic that Aeneas emerges from the gate of ivory. Part of the way one looks at this gate of ivory question will tell you how the scholar is interpreting the meaning as a whole. Is this a national epic? Is this a celebration of the grandeur of his Rome? Or is this Virgil's somewhat elegiac, regretful, fretful observation of war is hell? It's important to distinguish between what we call today poetry and what we call verse. I'm not sure the prose poetry distinction would have made a whole lot of sense to the ancients. By verse, I mean language that's semiotically marked in two ways. Marked, first of all, by the imposition of metrical regularity. Secondly, by the use of a special vocabulary, certain diction that you don't find in ordinary conversation. And thirdly, sometimes by the addition of music. Most ordinary conversations not so. But for Virgil's poetry, all of his work, the epilogues, the Georgics, and the Aeneid, the metrical pattern is what we call dactylic hexameter. Now a dactyl is a foot.
I would like you to notice dactylic hexameter. Just pick it up.
As a, in which you find one long syllable and two short syllables.
There'll be a definition.
The word dactylus in Reading's finger. So you find one long digit and two short ones. And that's just how the verse is constructed. He borrowed the verse pattern from Homer and Hesiod. The most famous example of dactylic hexameter in English is Longfellow's Abandonment, that starts out, the only poem I know about ancients, it starts out, "This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks." It's just dreadful, but everyone quotes it when they're citing that for the text. Epic poets allow themselves the privilege of replacing a dactyl with a sponge, which is long and long. And a lot of the verbal music in Virgil comes from the alternation of dactyls and spines, or the, I should say, the admixture. You never know how they're going to fall together. To find a line that's six dactyls is actually quite rare. There's a famous one where he's describing the hooves of the horses shaking the damp plain of their four-footed boar, and it goes like this. That's where you see tam-tada-tam-tada-tam all the way through the line. He's borrowing that notion of having the sound echo the sense, again from Homer, where in Book 11, Homer has Sisyphus rolling his stone up the hill, and then it rolls back down again in a six-dactyl line. Once again, down to the plain rolls the merciless stone, precious verse, ever penned by the Aeneid. So we know he's done tremendous care over every word, every syllable of this poetry. It's hard to overestimate just how meticulous. meticulous he was. It's important to hear the music and the beauty of the original Latin, and not just the costume of the English. Alma uoque can, proiae qui primus amoris, italia fato profumus, la vigna quevenit, liter amurus mille terris, lactatus, et alto vi supermus, sae vae memore, unonis of ira, multa quoque vendo opasus, domo conderet urbe, inter neque de os latio, genus unde latino, alma nique patres, ad valta emonia roma, musa mihi causas leona, quomine laeso, quidve dolens, regina de iontot, volvere pasus, insigne in pietate remont, tot agire labores, impunes, tant aena minis calestimus virae, urbs antiqua fuit, vidi brite nuera colore, carta do italiam contra tiberina quellonde ostia, dives opumus studiis aspergima bellum, quam uno vertur terris, magis omnibus una, post habita colubis cessamo, hic indius arma, hic currus fuit hoc regnum de agentibus esse, si qua fata sina, iam tu intendicque foetque. Progenie sedemini, proiaro a sangue di, audiat, filias olinque muerteret artes, inc populum latere regent, loque superbum, ventur ex ilio libiae, sic volvere partas. Id metque, with risque memor Saturnia belli, prima quod ad Troiam procaris deseret artis, neque iam causae raurum sae vique dolores expiderant algo. Man et alta mente repostum ludicium paribis, caeque inguria forma, et genus invisum rapti galleris honores. His accensa super, iacatus aequere toto, proas, reliquias dano aque nipta fin, archebat longe latio, multosque per annos, erra bant activatis, marionia circum, tanta in modi serrat romano condere gente.
That was really good.
One of the ways in which Virgil makes his music is by the repetition or echoing of words that are going to stick in the listener's mind. And you hear this in one line where he says, tanta in animis caelestibus virae, and then a few lines later he says, tanta in modi serrat romano condere gente. Was there so much anger in the souls of the immortals and in the hearts of the gods? Tanta modus erat. It was a matter of such gravity. It was so much trouble to found the Roman race. When you start looking at the poem line by line and word by word, you find this incredible richness that I've been talking about. Just to take the first three words, alma mioque can. I sing about arms and a male. You could almost translate in your ears, hero. Something that, as a Hendiadys, one by a two, a man of arms. And there may be some truth to that. I think the real Hendiadys is in Virgil's unifying the themes and, in some ways, the plot lines of Homer's Odyssey in books 1 through 6 of the Aeneid and Iliad in books 7 through 12. The arma really kind of encapsulates books 7 through 12. There's a lot constant, but we focus on the weird and the man himself of before and on. The cano is an interesting word because it literally means sick.
This means and here. That's the word for and. Arms, man, and And the word and comes after instead of before.
The wattes that play are holding his lyre and invoking the muses of ancient Greece to inspire him as they inspire Homer, who there was singing his epic to the lyre. The suffix que in real que is a way of saying and such that it won't disturb the meter that Virgil has to compose it, which is that killing hexameter. Troiae qui primus aboris itaido, patro profumus, la vinia que vein in lito. To put the grammar of those words together, you have to read all the way down to the beginning of the third line. This is called enjambment, and it's a good indication of how much Virgil is relying on the technology of the written word as he composes these lines. The oral poet, the poet who comes from a pre-literate society, is much more likely to end stop each line. But in Virgil, sometimes the syntax rolls on from line after line. It's quite complicated. The word troiai, right in the middle of the line, is an example of what we call hyperbaton. This is a word out of its natural syntactic order, if there is one. Although I should say here that the Romans depended a lot less on word order for meaning than we do in modern English. But to put it exactly in the center of the line there, the center of the first line of the whole poem, is a pretty good indication that this is an important word and important idea, a vital image. And it is that because Aeneas has had to flee the sack of Troy. He gets away by the skin of his teeth. And meanwhile, it's Virgil's way of reminding the Romans that they are the descendants of the Achaemenid. In Book 2 of the Aeneid, Virgil has Aeneas himself narrate the sack of Troy to this charming queen who's met Dido on the north shore of Africa. What's remarkable about the Aeneid is how much of an agent Dido is and how much agency she retains despite the vicissitude of her very sad story. So Aeneas has lost his wife just as Dido has lost her husband. But Dido has taken a vow of chastity after the death of her husband, Caius. Dido doesn't expect ever to fall in love again. She certainly doesn't expect to marry again. But here's this amazing man who shows up in Carthage, which is the city she's founded, and her falling in love for Aeneas is really a way of Juno punishing him. The Dido episode, if you will, is kind of a self-contained mini-story in the Aeneid. As a character, she really stands out as one of Virgil's most original creations. In Books 2 and 3, Aeneas has been telling Dido his story, and this recapitulates the way that Odysseus tells the king of Aegeus his story, catches us up on what's happened before the beginning of Book 1. At the beginning of Book 4, we're told how Dido is already falling in love with him. She's inflamed, and the word fire, words for fire, the image of fire, is a constant image of this burning power of passion. And of course, it finds its gruesome end in the literal fire, which throws herself on fuel fire and burns herself to death. But we're told at the very beginning of Book 4, Regina gravi gaudunus autia pura, vulnus alicus, et caico caudi. She's plucked, captured by blind fire. Some amazing imagery. She's got this wound, and I think it's the wound of her loss, her husband, and the wound of Cupid's arrow. And she talks about this to her sister Anna, and she says, Agnosco regalis vestigia lacrima. I recognize the traces of an old flame, meaning the fire of love that I once felt for my husband. One of the other things that, or the metaphors or symbols that he uses for love is as madness. He talks about her as being crazy. And again, we find this in modern English colloquial language. I'm crazy for you. I'm crazy about her. And so forth. But he really means nuts. She has lost her sanity. She has lost her balance. Once Aeneas shows up, she abandons everything. Quis fallere possit amante? Who, asks Virgil, can deceive a lover? She knows he's on his way. He's trying to sneak out of Carthage. But
who can deceive a lover?
Kings have to be in war where the whole group goes out hunting and suddenly there's a thunderstorm and everybody runs for cover from these massive storms. And lo and behold, Dido and Aeneas end up in the same cave trying to get out of the rain. And things develop considerably from there. Here's Virgil's description of that for a bit. Dido and the Trojan leader. Aeon them do the same. They win. They come down. They descend. And again, here's this heavily Jungian image. The next phrase is extremely important. He says, prima et telos, first earth, and proni by Juno, dom signo. Juno and telos, the goddess earth, give a sign. But she's called Cronu by Juno. Juno who presides over weddings. Is this so candid? Are they married? Everything in this passage is pointing to a wedding and thus to a marriage. And certainly, Dido will take it that way. It's to Aeneas' advantage not to see it that way because he's got a country to found. He's got to get out of here. He's Pelos Aeneas, after all. He's a person who takes his responsibilities seriously. Net young furti volido meditato labori. Conjugion vobet hoc graecetsit non le culpa. She calls it marriage. And with this name, she covers the culpa, the fault, the misdeed. What is the misdeed? Sleeping with this man, violating her vow, maybe? Part of the problem is that we're in an audience of Romans, you know, Augustus' day, thinking about one Phoenician woman and one Trojan man hundreds of years before. So under what law, or to what law are they subject? But at the beginning of Book 6, we see Aeneas talking to the Athenian Sibyl. The Sibyl is sending him to the underworld so that he can find the shade of Anchises, his father. Faculis descensus averno, the road, or the descent to Avernus, to the underworld, is easy. Sed revocare gradum, superasque vanere ad auras, hoc opus hic labores, she says. It's easy to get down there. Getting back out is the hard part. You can apply this utterance of the Sibyl on so many levels. There's certainly a very literal sense in which she's talking, but there's also clearly a moral register to it. You can interpret and apply this to so many things in human life. The monument is one of the most important narrative patterns, maybe the single most important narrative pattern that humans have come up with. It's the story, really, of a hero on a journey, either literal or figurative, in order to complete an impossible task. Along the way, he probably has a faithful sidekick. He certainly must be a wise counselor who gives him some vital information. And he will certainly undergo a catharsis, some kind of figurative or even literal death at rebirth, and a cataclysm event from which he can emerge.
You like that one? Where do you think I got that music from? My son's a disc jockey at IU. all right, let's do the biblical stuff. We got that's the setup. Let me go through the. Turn to page 1082. So I see there's some problems with some of the. If you write me a note, which are the. There's definitely some subtitling problems on there, but he's pretty interesting. This is a big work. He really deserves 20 minutes. But 1082. I want you to know a few recognize a few words there. All right. If you skim down in this about the 8 lines down, there's a reference to the covenant. Covenant and testament seem to be the same word. We have the Old Testament and the New Testament. That's a very Christian way of looking at the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible doesn't look at itself as the old anything. Okay, that's why they use that word Tanakh. Right? And you can make the argument, and I think it's pretty valid, especially based on Matthew, that everything in the Christian New Testament is already in the Old Testament. It was just hidden. Right? You needed to interpret it to get it out, and that was the point of the New Testament, but that's not exactly St. Paul's view of the matter. Well, here there's a reference to Jeremiah 31:31. You see that? So just underline that. You might want to pull it up on your computer. All you got to do is type in Jeremiah 31, and there's about 40,000 websites out there that'll give you the text. But it says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord." Remember, this is Jeremiah sitting there in Babylon in the Babylonian captivity about 500 B.C., so he's clearly talking about the release of the Jews, but Jesus taking it as much more metaphorical. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on that day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt." That was the big event, the exodus from Egypt. That was what formed the Hebrew nation. Right? "But this covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord, I will put my law within them. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts." Right? Now, that is the whole message of St. Paul. All right? You don't need sticks and stones. You don't need blocks of wood. You know, God is in your heart. Well, there it is. It's right in Jeremiah, too. So you can... Yeah, of course, you can say that's not the interesting part. I don't even care about that. But if you do care about that, it's interesting that it's already there. Well, this is the Old Testament moment that your introduction is saying that allowed the new covenant. All right. Now, there's the word gospels shows up a few lines later. You see that? Okay. So you should know what that means. The four gospels in the New Testament are the stories of the life of Jesus. You get four versions of his life. Then you get a bunch of letters, mainly written by St. You get the Acts of the disciples in Acts. Then you get a bunch of letters by St. Paul. Then you get this sort of wild book called Revelations. You want to do some interpretation, there's where you go. Okay, monsters running around with 10 heads and things like that. All right. Well, the word Gospels refers to those four books of the life of Jesus, right? By Luke, Mark, Matthew, and John, right? And again, the best introduction I know to them, if you get interested in it, are the Cliff Notes to the Old Testament. And I didn't have time to do a summary of them, but they're really interesting. One of the things they point out is each of these people who tells the life tells it in a different way, right? In other words, the birth of Matthew, I think, starts with all this genealogy, you know, how Jesus goes back to David. Well, the other guys couldn't care less about that stuff, so they just leave it out, right? Luke has the big version of the birth, the Christmas story, but the other authors just aren't as concerned with that, right? So they each have a different audience that they're writing for, and this is what your introduction is talking about over on page 1083, I think is where it does. So you can pick this out, but look at the audience. Luke is writing for Greeks. Mark is writing for Gentiles who don't know any Hebrew. Matthew is writing for Jews looking for the Messiah, and John is writing for theologians. So you can pick that up out of the thing yourself. I won't go over it. Let's go back to 1082 for a minute. So we got that word Gospels. And the word means good news, right? Comes from a Greek word, evangelion, okay, which means bringing the news. That angelion word is the same word as angel. And an angel in Greek, the word in Greek means the messenger. So I guess evangelion would be carrying the messages. And allegedly the messages are good. So it's the good news. Okay? I'm going to pause over that. I hope I'm getting this on tape because it's one of the more complicated things I've ever said in my life. And in a few days, you're going to be looking at the tape on my series of Islam. Okay? And that's maybe even next week. And the guy is fairly incomprehensible. He's one of my worst graduate students I got to read from the Quran. And I'm going to have to replace the tape, but it's all I have this semester. But he will make the point, as he's analyzing a passage from the Quran, about an angel coming down. And I'll say, well, what's the meaning? He says, well, you don't need an explanation. We all know that angels are good. Okay, it's just this assumption. You don't even know. There's no question that they exist, and there's no question what they mean. Islam is very direct in that way. Okay, it's not like a big argumentative religion. Okay, but it's the same point, isn't it? The good news, the evangelion, the angels are good. So if the message is coming from God, it must be good. Right, just that assumption. And if you're in a pessimistic mood and you're feeling like some 19th century Danish philosopher, you can say, well, I don't know if it's good or not, I'm scared. And that's a kind of normal reaction, actually, and it's certainly part of Virgil, but if you don't want to go insane, you just figure it's good. Okay, so anyway, that's the word gospel. Two lines later, you might underline the word fulfillment. We've talked about this before, that the New Testament is thought to fulfill the Old Testament. Right? And they say here, the Old Testament was to the new as body to the spirit. Here are all the laws, but we don't know quite what they mean. We don't know the spirit to take them in. They all seem so oppressive in the Old Testament. It's just the Jews do something, and then they backslide, and God has to come slap them around, and then they get good for a while, and then they fall apart again. God has to come down and flood them out, or disperse them, or it's just this constant series of not getting it right, all right, and then being called back to God. All right. So the view was that the New Testament sort of explained what that was all about. So spirit is really a synonym here for interpretation. Right? They read that history and they figured, why should I read that? Well, because there's this message. And then you say, well, if I got the message, why should I bother to read it? And not something I can do about that, or like any other class. Well, the word for this fulfillment, this prefiguring in the Old Testament, I gave it to you before, it wasn't on the exam, is typology. You see it there in italics? Typology. Moses, for example, was a type of Jesus. I guess he leads his people, or something like that, right? The flood, a type of the coming of God's kingdom. Right. The example I gave before was Jonah going down into the whale for 3 days. Right. A 3-day descent into the darkness became the type for the time between the crucifixion on Friday and the resurrection on Sunday. Right, so that was playing this out. Matthew is particularly concerned with pointing out these correspondences. Right, the other guys aren't quite that interested in it. In your selections here, they leave out John completely. Right? All right, now John is different from the other three. The first three guys are called the Synoptic Gospels because they're really kind of about the life, but John is much more theological. And he starts right off, and I've got a tape of this, so this is something I want you to know. He starts right off by saying, in the beginning was the Word. Right? That's the first line. That's all we need to know for this class, but we sort of need to know how to think about it. And the first lines, you want to look at the other Greek tape by Professor Patrice Rankin in the Foreign Languages, and he'll talk about that a little bit. But the message is John is being wildly difficult. In the beginning, well, that certainly sounds like something we've seen at the beginning of the whole Genesis, but the Word, what's the Word? I thought it was God created the heaven and earth. Well, he's saying, no, that's not quite what was going on there. Those 7 days of creation were actually about the Word, but the Word is logos. That's the Greek word, which means logic or reason or being. So what you should have gotten out of those 7 days of creation was that some sort of rational intellectual process was being brought into formation, but I'm not going to explain it to you, okay? Because it's too difficult. But just to put it in shorthand, I'm giving you the life of Jesus, but that's what he's all about. And you can go read the Christmas story, and you can look at his genealogy, and you can think about his mother, but that's not what counts as far as John is concerned. Jesus is that logical element itself. He is the Word. And the other stuff is unimportant. That's just a bunch of words of Adam. So that gets pretty complicated, doesn't it? Right? So a lot of people, they want to think about him as a man, and John says, not me. That's completely irrelevant stuff. Right? Completely irrelevant stuff. So everybody's got a different interpretation. And I'm sorry they didn't give you a passage in John, but you need to think about that. Because again, when you the actual experience of reading the Gospels is really, you can't figure it out. Okay? There's this guy Jesus, and he is just weird. He just appears here, he appears there, he says stuff nobody can understand. He goes and he comes. He's got full of contradictory advice, right? And really the message is the mystery that you're not really supposed to have it figured out. There's a great movie version of it, and it ain't by Mel Gibson. It's a really stupid version, okay? But the guy named Pasolini in Italy did a wonderful movie called The Gospel According to St. Matthew, and it really captures that sort of disjointed, inexplicable quality of this character. Right. People today think, oh, there was one guy. But, you know, the evidence is we don't have the story of one guy. We have four different stories, all of them equally authentic, if you're looking for that, and they don't coincide. That's the big message. If you actually sit and read the stuff and start comparing it, you'll get contradictory images. So how do you figure out what's right? I'm gonna leave that there. It helps to be a good person, is what C.S. Lewis says. You know, if you're a good person, you'll come up with the right message. If you're a bad person, it'll probably be the bad message. That's as far as I can go, not being a theologian myself. This is a literature class, and that's what we want to notice. Nonetheless, these passages didn't really pick out the literary quality, so let's look at them quickly. Wait a minute, do I need... Yeah, the other point, the last point on page 1083 is, what's the language of the New Testament? And then again, you'll get this, you'll know this from the second tape you read, so you will not mess up on the exam. But in Jesus' day, everybody was speaking a form of Hebrew, not classical Hebrew, that the Old Testament was written in, but languages always develop, so it was called Aramaic, but it was a form of Hebrew. And the one thing Mel Gibson's film did, it used this Aramaic. But when they went to write down the stories, they didn't write it down in Hebrew or Aramaic. The stories of by Luke, Matthew, Mark, and John were written in Greek, because that was the language of the educated class. That side of the Mediterranean was Greek-speaking and had been since Alexander the Great had brought Greek culture essentially from Macedonia all the way to the far reaches of the Hindu Kush, which is eastern Afghanistan. Okay? It's a fascinating thought that after Alexander the Great got all the way out to eastern Afghanistan and back, and then he died, his empire divided up, but no Western European army got into Afghanistan until the British arrived in 1830. Okay. And believe me, no Western army wants to be there. Okay. And what we're doing there is, there's the one thing you know from history, stay out of Afghanistan. You know, the Russians went in there and they got clobbered, and that was the end of the Russian Empire. Right? They were so easily beaten, even Ronald Reagan could beat them by sending in a few grenade launchers. And you know what Osama bin Laden was doing. He was working for us, firing grenade launchers at Russian helicopters, and they'd beat the crap out of them. And the Russians had to leave. And now we're in there, so you figure it out. Okay. I can't. Anyway, I drifted off there. Anyway, the New Testament is written in Greek because that was Greek culture, right? Greek culture was everywhere, and you want to know that. That's why John can, you know, talk about the word logos, which is a Greek word, like as in logical. Right? So let's page 1084, the birth of Jesus. What do we need to know there? Well, everybody, they're very Jewish. I hope you notice that. They're all following the law of Moses, the birth. All the rituals are being followed. You see a reference there in the last paragraph to the law of Moses, that there's a purification ceremony for the woman, okay, whatever, the law of Moses. Well, then you have this guy Simeon looking at Jesus and predicting the resurrection. Okay. Well, that's the big event, right, of the New Testament. Not for every thinker, but for a lot of thinkers, that's it, because this is the event that allegedly overcomes death. Right? This is meeting that dream of immortality, okay, but doing it properly. Not the immortality Calypso offered Odysseus. I'll let you live here forever and we can live in our cave and make a love forever. And this is going, I'm already bored. You know, what am I going to be in 1,000 years? You know, this is a different kind of, this is the sort of the love that doesn't wear out. Okay? So we get that prediction here, and of course it gets fulfilled, right? But prophecies are just a form of ancient literature. We've seen it in everything. Now, at the bottom of the three lines from the end of this section, the one little event that happens is they go to Jesus is 12, and the family goes up to Jerusalem, and then they're going home, and they turn around, and Jesus isn't there. He's in the temple teaching. And they say, why don't you come home to where your father and I live? And he says, I am in my father's house. Right? You go, what does that mean? Your father lives up there in Galilee. He doesn't live here in the temple in Jerusalem. And four lines up, it says, and they did not understand what he had said to them. This is the key. This is the only thing I really want you to get out of this. They didn't understand it. He said something nobody could figure out. He does this all the time. The parables are meant not to be understood. This is the big paradox. Keeps the mystery. He's got his reasons. You don't make it too easy for people. This is the intellectual side of Christianity. Keep people working at it. But in fact, it's like Joseph's dream. Seems mysterious, but it isn't. 12 sheaves bow down. I wonder what that means. Right? That was the one. Well, here, who is the father? The father is the variable term. When he says, I'm in my father's house and he's in the temple, he doesn't mean Joseph, does he? He means his heavenly father. He means God, the father. That wasn't that hard, was it? Right? On the one hand, it is hard. On the other hand, it is. If you know the answer, quote, know the answer, it's not so hard. So the parables basically all respond. They're all talking about the kingdom of heaven. But what's so difficult is you can't know anything about it. You can't know anything about it. It's just the way it works. That's Plato's allegory in the cave. And if you do know something about it, nobody will believe you. Right? Given that paradox that nobody's going to believe you, how do you get your religion across to people? Don't ask me, but the answer they came up with is you write these stories. Okay, you write these gospels. All right, and you write a bunch of letters and you tack on the X, and you know that's how they did it. Right, using these stories. Well, we got 2 minutes for the Matthew 5-7, and if I was a better teacher, we could have a wild class discussion about this. But what strikes me, is this is really different from anything else. Okay, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. I don't think point it out to me if we've read it, but I haven't noticed anybody standing up for the poor people yet this semester. What we've read are a bunch of really aristocratic war stories about heroes, and you know the common people just die, like you know minimum wage workers in a Republican Congress. The hell of them, okay, right? You know, why should they get in my way when I can be richer than I am now, right? This is really, really a remarkable view of the world, okay? That your religion is about supporting the average life of the average person. And the last point I want to make is he says on page 1086, you see in the second full paragraph that starts, you are the salt of the earth. Well, I don't, you know, God, salt? That's not my point. The point is, the next line, you are the light of the world, he says. A city cannot be hidden when it is set on top of a hill. Skipping down, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good works. Be good and let everybody see it. Don't hide your light under a bushel, right? That's what he's telling me to do. Jump over to 1087. After the break there, take care not to practice your righteousness publicly before men so as to be seen by them. What? Now don't ask me which is the correct one, but the text is telling you what the other texts are telling you. You have to interpret this. Okay? You can do it like a bad person, you can do it like a good person. I really can't control that. Anyway, it's just screaming out that this needs to be interpreted because it contradicts. The contradiction is apparent. Right? If you can resolve it, you can do it first thing on Tuesday. See ya.